This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Meera Sivasuthi. The FBI began investigating what we now call hate crimes as far back as World War I when the Ku Klux Klan first attracted our attention. And today we remain dedicated to working with state and local partners to prevent these crimes and to bring to justice those who commit them. Not just hate crime, the whole load of other types of crime in the world today. I mean, in Malaysia, we're very, very concerned about escalating crime rates, and with me to shed more light all the way from the UK are Paul Igansky, who is from the Law School of Lancaster University, Dr. Stuart Kirby, who's a criminology lecturer also at Lancaster University, as well as a chartered psychologist, together with Professor Alasdair, who's a member of the UK Council for Child Internet Safety. He's also from the Law School of Lancaster University. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. How are you today?
Very well.
You've come in full force. I mean, you're here to... what brings you to Malaysia? And I understand this is your first trip here.
We're exploring Lancaster University's association with Sunway University, and exploring the potential for teaching programs in criminology. Mm-hmm. Such programs are very popular in the UK.
Okay, all right then. So all of you, of course, are from Lancaster University, and I'm assuming that you have a pretty strong department looking at crime. Alasdair, you just want to tell me a little bit more about that? I mean, what else can you look at? I mean, we don't really think about, you know, studying crime in university.
Yeah, I think the law school covers lots of things, but one of the exciting things we've just brought our criminology colleagues in from this year, and it means that we can start looking at all the different types of crime, but also some of the legal responses, but why crime happens and what kind of strategies you can do to try and prevent crime.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I will just start with Paul. I mean, you have an interest in hate crimes. Why is that?
It's a significant social problem in many, many nation states. The notion of hate crime is developed in the United States, the post-civil rights era. Mm-hmm. But I think the idea that there is such a thing as hate crime is now a worldwide phenomenon.
It is.
And it's a significant social problem. Mm-hmm. And in the UK, it's a significant social problem. We estimate that there are about 500,000 hate crimes happening every year.
Right, 500,000.
About 500,000.
Wow, that's a lot. I mean, and how would you define hate crime? What constitutes hate crime?
Well, in essence, it's a crime that occurs either because the victim is targeted because of their race or ethnicity. Mm-hmm. That's the predominant type of hate crime that we experience in the UK, in the United States, elsewhere in Europe. Mm-hmm. But also, you find that disabled people are targeted, increasingly targeted. And in countries in Europe, people are targeted because of their religion. We have Muslims who are targeted, Jewish people who are targeted, mm-hmm. in the UK. It's a diverse phenomenon. Essentially, it's where a crime occurs because of somebody's identity, right. Or in the commission of a crime, some aspect or reference is made to the person's identity. They're abused because of their identity.
Okay, so that's the difference between hate crime and other sorts of crime, would you say, is this whole question of identity?
That's right. The same types of crime, all crimes occur for some reason, mm-hmm. and they're the same types of crime, but where there's an extra element that the person is targeted because of their identity.
Okay. Is it sort of linked to power in any way, hate crimes and power?
Well, hate crimes are a diverse phenomenon, and so they occur between all communities, but it's not an equal opportunities phenomenon. So if you're a member of a minority community in a society, and this is certainly the case in the UK and the United States, mm-hmm. members of minority communities are far more likely to be a victim of a hate crime, mm-hmm. than if you're somebody who looks like me, a white-skinned male. there are hate crimes against people like me, but the odds of me being targeted in a hate crime are far, far less, yeah. than if my skin was black, or if I was Muslim, or if I was Jewish.
Yeah, okay. Alasdair, you have actually sort of specialised in sexual crimes against children.
Yes.
I mean, you have a special interest in that. Rape, pornography, molestation. I mean, that's something that we seem to be talking about so much. Worldwide, it's happening. I mean, with the onset of social media, things like that. How would you define sexual crimes against children?
I think one of the issues is there's lots of different types out there, again, and one of the problems combating this is different countries have different definitions, but really there tends to be three types. So there's the rape type, which is penetrative activity against children. Most people decide that consent is irrelevant to that because children can't consent.
Yep.
You've then got non-penetrative assaults, so sexual touching and things like that. And then the third form tends to be the pornography. But on top of that, you've got exploitation like prostitution, for example, or trafficking. But they're the three principal barriers of crime.
Okay. And what got you going with this area? I mean, I think when I read of the work that you've actually done, what got to me is that, you know, when you have your own family and your own children, do you sort of get paranoid, you know, being exposed to so much, you know, sexual crime cases? I mean, doesn't it make you extra protective of your daughters and sons, for an example?
Well, I'm quite lucky I don't have any, so
is that the reason why?
I think one of the things is you can't get paranoid with it. I think one of the things is it's separating out the perception and the reality. So you know why crimes occur, you know how they occur, what the likely factors are and things like that. And therefore, you would never put your family in that kind of position where it can. It's not to say that nothing will ever happen. But then again, if we were worried about everything, we'd never step outside because we think a bus might hit us or a car might hit us. So there's that kind of understanding how you can minimize the likelihood of things happening and then just accepting that risks happen. That's part of life.
Right. Are you trying to say it's just question of probabilities? I mean,
there can be. I mean, part of it is making sure you're not in position. So if somebody's looking after your children, you make sure that you know who they are. Have they been vetted? Have they got experience of it? You wouldn't necessarily just give your child to anybody to look after. So that's a key way of minimizing things.
Okay.
Making sure that your children understand they can say no to things. So it's things like that. So there's education you can do with a lot to minimize sexual behavior.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Stewart, Paul, I mean, how do you feel about this? Is it all about perception when it comes to crime? Because I had a criminologist from USM, University of Sains Malaysia in Penang, who told me the same thing, you know, in terms of interpreting crime data, it goes beyond interpretation. Is it perception for you as well?
Perception is very important because you get crimes that happen not as often, but the impact on the individual is disproportionate to the actual number of crimes. So I think one of the benefits of studying criminology is that you also look at the impact of the victim. So if that perception makes you stay indoors and do things, as Alistair says, don't engage in certain things, you need to sort of take those things into account. So criminology, as well as understanding the crime, it's knowing the impact it has on other individuals as well.
All right. I always think, you know, when we've got a lot of snatch thefts, you know, cases in the Klang Valley, and also we have these incidents where you're stuck in traffic, you're at a traffic light, you can't go anywhere, someone comes and smashes your window, and there goes your bag. There could be something there, there may not be anything there. Right? I can't do anything in a situation like that. So then, you know, what do you have to say about that? I mean, how do you counter a situation like this? What does this go back to?
Well, Paul came up with a good point before when he said that hate crime isn't random, and no crime is random. We know it occurs in particular places, particular times, on particular people. And really, it's understanding the patterns of the crime so the police can target a particular area. So in Kuala Lumpur, just as any city in the world, mm-hmm. there will be particular hotspots which will occur at particular times. So it's understanding why the offenders are attracted to a particular vehicle in a particular place and to try and work on solutions around that.
Okay. I'm sure you would have had this problem in the UK as well. You know, you would have gone through this phase that Malaysians seem to be going through in terms of crime. We have this huge insecurity when it comes to crime now. How did you handle that in the UK? Did you have to work closely with the police force, or, you know, who are the stakeholders in this?
Yeah, I think about 20 years ago, I think there was a realisation that there was an awful lot of money being wasted in the police force and the criminal justice system. And there was a move to what was called intelligence-led policing. So lots of effort was placed on understanding where the crime took place and how it took place. and there was a lot more transparency with information around crime. It was that the police would keep that information to themselves. I think the bigger picture was that the more people that can engage on policing, that can take care of their own belongings and their own families, the more people who did that understood crime, the more that we could reduce crime as a sort of larger society. Mm-hmm. So I think the professionalisation of the police and that wider level of information made a real impact.
Okay. Why is it so important to have people like yourselves who have this background in criminology? How do you contribute towards, you know, our safety in general? Do we need more people to become criminologists?
Well, sharing experience is critical in terms of tackling crime. There's experience all over the world, many models of intervention, and so rather than starting from scratch, we're all learning from each other. Mm-hmm. and models of policing. And my colleague Stuart was talking about the use of intelligence. It's critical. And critical for victims to report crime. For quite a number of crimes, a majority of victims don't report the crimes. Yes.
Yeah, well, isn't the same in the UK? It's the same thing here.
Absolutely.
What are the reasons people don't report this in the UK?
Well, there are many, many reasons, and it differs for particular types of crimes. But if I turn to racist violence, for instance, mm-hmm. My own area of specialism, surprisingly, a majority of victims don't report such crimes. Our British Crime Survey shows that. And when asked, victims say they don't want to go to the trouble of going to the police station. Mm-hmm. They think police might think it's too trivial.
Yep.
They might think the offender will never be caught.
Mm-hmm.
I myself was a victim. I was racially abused in the street, and never reported the crime myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, what's the point? I was on the way to work. I didn't want to take the afternoon off work. I didn't have the presence of mind to take the offender's car number plate. Thought the police would never catch them. And the police say to me, Paul, victims always say that to us.
Yes, exactly.
But we need these crimes reporting. Mm-hmm. And this is important intelligence to understand these patterns, and that's critical.
Yep. Alasdair, I can imagine in your area of sexual crimes how important it is to make that police report. How do we make sure that more and more people come forward to report sexual crimes?
It is important, and I think it's an area where historically there hasn't been, including until very recently in Britain, there was a lot of people who didn't do it because there was the message that you wouldn't be believed. And I think that's part of the thing now. So a lot of it now is making sure that police officers aren't sceptical. You know, they actually take a report at full face value. You'll have specialist investigators who know how to talk to children, know how to get things out, reassuring victims that they will be believed and that things will happen. Generally, a lot of offenders will turn around to people and say, don't tell anybody, you won't be believed.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time, the criminal justice system was living up to that. So something would happen, you'd say that, and the first question that a defence lawyer would ask is, you're making this up, aren't you? Or the
yep.
police would ask that. And therefore, all of those horrors came true. So now it's about educating the police, the bar, the judiciary, social workers, everyone working together to find out ways of helping reassure people that if something does happen, it will be treated seriously, whilst accepting that, you know, there has to be a trial.
Mm-hmm.
But there will be ways of reassuring people to know that it is necessary to report and you will be taken seriously.
Okay, and what do you do with this data? Once you get it, what do you do with all these reports?
Well, you analyse it to prioritise what you're going to do with the resources that are available at that time. But I think often, you know, there are a number of levels. So you can say to the public, you can do this, and that will reduce crime. You can also say to the police, focus on that particular area. But with a lot of crime prevention work, and you see this across the world, it's becoming more and more innovative that you can find sustainable solutions to some of these long-standing problems.
Okay, when we come back, we'll find out more about organised crime, which is Stuart's area of specialty. And it's something that we're going through at the moment as well. When we come back, if you have a question for either of the gentlemen, send it through. The number is 016-2019-1000 or tweet BFM Radio.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Meera Sivasuthi. I have a whole troop of criminologists, lecturers and experts in crime with me. Paul Igansky from the Law School of Lancaster University, together with Professor Alistair, who's also from the Law School, Dr. Stuart Kirby, who's a criminology lecturer at Lancaster University, as well as a chartered psychologist. You know, when I think about crime, you know, after reading whatever I've read, you know, in the papers and stuff like that, is it my perception that crime is actually on the rise in Malaysia?
Well, that's a really difficult question to answer, because obviously we don't come from Malaysia. But let me just give you a quick anecdote. I was previously in the police for 30 years, and I once went to a community meeting. The community had asked for me to go and talk about crime. I went with all my crime statistics, thinking they'd be patting me on the back and a promotion would be due. I was fending off all these questions, and then somebody stood up and said, "I've got a question for you, Mr. Kirby." I said, "Oh, what's that?" "If it is so safe round here, why have you got a constable outside, a patrol officer, guarding your car?" And I think the point is that so much is unreported, or people get a perception of what it's like because they see graffiti on the streets, they'll see damage, that they often do build up that picture. So I couldn't say whether how much perception is affecting you, because it'll affect individuals differently. All I can say, the more information that is put out there, people can make that decision on themselves.
Okay. Well, you have a lot of experience with organised crime, Dr. Stuart, as well as dealing with gang members and things like that. I mean, what should we be considering when it comes to policing these sort of crimes?
I think that good practice across the world, the first thing you've got to do is understand the problem. So people will say organised crime, but what do they really mean by it? So what the research shows is that there's lots of different varieties of organised crime done at all different levels. So if you've got a street gang problem who are dealing with snatches of purses and things like that, it will need a different response and a different solution to somebody much higher level who's bribing officials and being involved in human trafficking and things like that. So I think the first point is to make sure you know what the problem is. And then the response always, in my experience, always fits under three criteria. Enforcement, so crackdowns, which is often the easiest thing to do, but has limited effect, because often it'll just give a job vacancy for the next aspiring offender. You can do disruption, so you can make it a very hostile environment for organised crime groups to work. Or you can become more involved in prevention, which tries to look at that problem in real detail, understand the people involved, the process of the how they commit their offences, and you can try and put a sustainable solution to that.
How long did it take the UK to actually get your act together, as far as, you know, bringing everyone together to combat crime? As you said, police force, you know, everyone on social workers, everyone has to be on the same page. How long did it take you?
Still, in a lot of areas, it probably still hasn't. I think it's very difficult for people to come together. One of the interesting things about the UK is, for instance, in England, there's 43 separate police forces who all work individually together, have a broad area. Now, they're trying to bring things together into regional groupings or even national, but then there's politics get involved in terms of who deals with what. So whilst it's getting better, I don't think you could ever turn around and say that any country really has worked out what the solution is yet. I think we're all still learning and developing, but certainly in a lot of areas, I think it's true to say that we're still not working off the same page.
Really?
I would agree with that. But back in 1998, there was a significant act that came in the UK called the Crime and Disorder Act. And for the first time, it forced, through legislation, different partner agencies, so the police, local governments, to come together and to say, to do an audit of crime in their particular area and then work together on a plan to reduce it. So that was really significant, and it's very good in laying the foundations, but as Alistair says, the implementation of it is very difficult to bring different people together.
All right. How do you incentivize the right people to actually go out there and apprehend these criminals? I think, and we're of course talking about the police force to a very large extent, how do we get them mobilized, motivated to actually go out there and, you know, do their jobs?
I think the that's probably the easiest question you've asked me, actually. I think it all comes down to leadership, yep. Political and senior police leadership. You look at really impressive policing anywhere in the world and you can track it back to good leaders who feel that they can make a difference and they've generated that enthusiasm for the people who work with them.
Okay. Alasdair, I mean, what can governments do to police or to bring about better prevention for sexual crimes against children? Because that's something that, you know, bothers a lot of us who are parents and, you know, talk about.
It does. I think one of the experiences that the UK has shown is that education's important, and that means explaining why the agencies all need to work together, making everybody the first line. So one of the things is, you know, we tend to think of the police force as being the investigators and things like that, but actually the police aren't necessarily going to be in day-to-day contact with children, whereas school teachers will be. So one of the things is using the school teachers to identify signs of abuse, mm-hmm. so that they don't start an investigation, because that's what the police should do. So it's working out each agency has its own abilities and it's the best at doing things, and then bringing them together and saying, look, if we actually work as one team here, we can cover most of the bases. And that's where you've got to do it. So part of it is actually just educating people that actually you can make a difference, and educating parents about the realities of sex crime. So that's, you know, it's such an awful crime, a parent is naturally going to worry about it. But actually, as I said kind of at the beginning, quite often there are ways of minimizing it, and there's that difference between perception and realities. And so a lot of it is to do with that. But I think the key question, as Stuart was saying about the Crime and Disorder Act, the same act brought in and said you had to have multi-agency working. And as soon as you start getting all the different governmental and public agencies working together with the schools, with the healthcare providers and things like that, you suddenly get a lot more opportunities to intervene before anything really happens, right. Or very early after it's happened.
Okay, so political will is really the solution here, isn't it? What about yourself, Paul? I mean, in terms of hate crimes, in as far as prevention is concerned, I mean, how have you been working with that?
Again, education is the key, and particularly with young people. As offenders don't often appreciate the impacts of their actions, and you know, because these crimes don't occur in a vacuum, they occur in the context of racist attitudes about disabled people, attitudes about people from particular reasons, mm-hmm. that are widespread, and they provide the context for hate crimes. And many offenders just act on those attitudes, often unthinkingly. Now, a great deal of work is being carried out in working, especially with young people in schools and colleges, and by anti-racist NGOs, to get people to appreciate, understand the consequences of racial abuse, mm-hmm. understand the consequences of bullying somebody. It all starts in the playground.
Yeah.
And understanding the consequences for the person on the receiving end.
Right.
And not only with potential offenders before they offend, but with actual offenders. As hate crimes are particularly hurtful, if you're targeted because of your identity, or somebody abuses you because of your identity, it's something you can't change, and why should you? It strikes at the core of who you are, and you carry it around with you, mm-hmm. Like a badge. So it hurts particularly. Often offenders don't appreciate this, and there are some very imaginative schemes that work with offenders and help them through to understand the consequences. In our own region, in Lancashire, there's been a very effective scheme, and it shows that it's beginning to reduce reoffending. So education, not only in schools, but with offenders,
okay.
To appreciate the consequences of their actions.
How much of this goes back to values and, you know, how it's inculcated in children at home?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's where it starts. And if we think of attitudes of prejudice, of bigotry, it all begins in the home, and is passed down from parents to children.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's reproduced at school, reproduced through the media. The media play a critical role in stoking and inflaming attitudes as well.
Okay.
And that's what we're battling against.
Okay, media. Let's talk about the media. Alasdair, how much does the media play in highlighting crime? Are we doing more good, or are we causing more harm to the whole situation?
I think it's both. I mean, in a way, responsible media is a fundamental part of it, and I think one of the things is responsible journalism can put pressure on. We've talked about political will, mm-hmm. both at local level and national level, and I think the media are very good at doing that, so they can draw attention to things that need to be dealt with. I think there's also some irresponsible journalism as well that can cause it the other way, so that if people sensationalize things or bring things out or start saying, oh, you know, you can't step out of your door because this is going to happen or that happen, then the converse happens. So I think there's that balance, and I think, you know, yourself, you know, the media has different wings of it, but I think generally media is a force for good.
Okay. You know, I was very, very interested in Stuart's work. You've worked as a hostage negotiator. Could you share that experience with me?
Yeah, it was very stressful.
I can imagine.
Yeah, it's I suppose the police in the UK get very intensive, all the hostage negotiators get very intensive training before they engage with it, because you can imagine the situation. You've got the offenders working together and there's a real dynamic there, the adrenaline's pumping, you know, there's a lot on the line for them. You've got the family, the people associated with the victim, they're distraught, obviously want to do everything they can but not thinking as clearly. So the police have got a really important role trying to be objective to make sure there isn't an act or something said which just inflames the whole situation, mm-hmm. which doing everything they can to bring around a good outcome.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting, because in hostage negotiation, in kidnapping cases for an example, how is the media supposed to react to situations like that? Because we had one incident here where a child was actually kidnapped.
Yes.
And it went viral on social media.
Right.
The child was eventually found, dead.
Yes.
And, you know, many of us were wondering whether this widespread awareness on social media, whether that, in fact, had contributed to the boy's death.
Yes.
So how do we draw those boundaries, and how far do we really go as far as reporting is concerned? And you've got social media, no control over that.
No, well, that's the real problem. In the UK, there's a voluntary agreement between all the media agencies that they will never broadcast anything surrounding a kidnap until the police have and the family have dealt with it. Now, as you point out, with social media, it's a completely different environment we're going into, and social media, as you know, creates all sorts of issues.
It makes your work in hate crimes more difficult as well, isn't it? You have online...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And many of these crimes are expressive crimes, people abusing others. And social media, now for a few years, has provided a new forum and a growing forum.
Yeah.
And we see reports over the last couple of years of all sorts of people, public personalities, footballers, entertainers, being abused, racially abused over Twitter and other social media.
Mm-hmm.
So we now have a new environment and new opportunities for people to vent their prejudices and these attitudes.
Is there, of course, enforcement is very difficult, but has the UK moved towards legislation in curbing such crime on online crime?
Indeed. We've had specific criminal laws against racist abuse, for instance, against religiously based abuse for quite a number of years. And the criminal law in terms of malicious communications, mm-hmm. Is changing in terms of our Communications Act. We have specific laws that are used against things. But the companies also have a responsibility.
Of course. And when we come back after the market update, we're going to find out more about child pornography, which is, of course, Alasdair's alley. Alasdair, I'm coming back to you right after this on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon and welcome back. It is The Bigger Picture. It's Meera Sivasuthi. We're discussing crime. Paul Igansky, from the Law School of Lancaster University. Dr. Stuart Kirby, who is a criminology lecturer at Lancaster University. He's also a chartered psychologist. And of course, Professor Alasdair, who is also from the Law School of Lancaster University. With me, we're discussing various types of crimes. The gentlemen have specialized in certain areas. Paul in hate crime. Dr. Stuart in crime prevention, actually. Mm-hmm. Hostage negotiation. investigations and things like that. And of course, Professor Alasdair in child sexual crimes. Alasdair, how much does pornography in general contribute to sexual crimes against children?
It's one of the things that is probably the great unknown. We have a lot of conflicting research on whether it makes any difference or not. The reality is it depends on the offender. General pornography, so general everyday adult pornography, doesn't probably make any impact, save that if you're already suffering from cognitive distortions, you're already having distorted thinkings about sex, then obviously that can then lead on to things. But generally speaking, most people think it doesn't make a significant difference. Mm-hmm. But the problem is it can to certain people, and therefore you've got the interesting dilemma about, if you know it has an impact on certain people, does that mean you should regulate it to stop those certain people getting it? And I think that's where it becomes more tricky.
Yeah. As a chartered psychologist, Stuart, does that make it more difficult in terms of dealing with people who are involved in child pornography?
I think, as Alistair says, the more information you get, especially about the individual, the easier it is to understand what to do in terms of the response. I think a lot of the time you'll listen to people giving their opinion and anecdotes, and responses which are made on that basis are often very dubious.
Okay, how do we sort of arrest this problem? You know, as soon as we realise, I mean, it's very hard to sort of pinpoint who would be an offender online, isn't it?
I think there's a difference between adult pornography and child pornography as well. So one of the things is child pornography has to involve children by its very nature and being abused. So mm-hmm. I think it's easier to tackle that form than it is more general pornography. So I think that's where most of the focus has been. And you can have a zero tolerance in relation to child pornography because it involves the abuse of children. So therefore tackling that becomes easier. In the internet age, it's obviously more difficult because it can be housed anywhere in the world.
That's right.
But most countries will adopt the approach of taking down child pornography when they see it. In terms of how you do it, part of it is intelligence. One of the things is the internet is allowing more people access to it. So one of the things is we don't know if there's more child sex offenders now or whether we're just getting better at finding them.
Right.
One of the things is the internet makes it a lot easier to find it. So before the internet, finding child pornography was relatively difficult. With the internet, with a few clicks, you can find it. But also it provides better opportunities for us to find those people. So for example, if they're using credit cards to buy the pornography, once we find the server that hosts the child pornography site, we've then got a list of people's credit card details so we can report to them.
Right.
Working with the banks allows you to do things. So the technology has both advantages and disadvantages in terms of how you would tackle it.
Would you say you've been quite successful at arresting the problem of child pornography?
I think we're getting better at it globally and particularly in the UK, but I think again it's difficult to say we're doing all of it. There's always this issue, and Stuart might be able to expand on this a bit more, is there's always the issue about to what extent are we finding the stupid offenders.
Mm.
And to what extent do we find, you know, so if you're very good at being a criminal, can you trace your steps? And with the internet, there's a lot of opportunity to that. And there is an issue with that. Are we finding people who are stupid enough to use a credit card?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it we finding both levels? And I think we are getting better at finding everybody rather than just the stupid ones.
Okay.
But part of that is resourcing. It's very easy to make 50 arrests by getting the low-level people. Actually, sometimes getting the higher-level ones will take a lot more resources. And you've got that balance about trying to decide which one you care about most.
Right. Stuart?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. In fact, similar analogy with organised crime. For many years, the UK police just focused on what we call the low-hanging fruit,
mm-hmm.
the ones easiest to reach, which makes little impact, really, because you don't disrupt the infrastructure behind it, and people just come along and replace them. So I think it is one of the lessons that we've learned, and more information, more research. Different tactics can sort of impact against that.
What about Paul? Has that impacted the area of hate crime as well?
Absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely. The materials available on the internet are very easy. Racist materials are very easy to find.
Right.
Just need to do a Google search, and many sites operating in the United States under protections of freedom of expression. You know, years ago, when I started a decade and a half ago researching this area, it was very hard for me to get hold of racist materials. I needed to keep very bad company, go to dangerous places to try and get racist newspapers from far-right extremist organisations to see the messages that they were banding around. And it was the same for young people. These things weren't easy to get. Now, in the next minute, I could find 100 racist websites. I can download racist films. I can download a racist music. And so this is the battle that we're facing. This material nowadays is so easy to get hold of.
Right, but you obviously can't be going after every one of them. I mean, in terms of resources, you only have so much. So what do you do then?
Well, again, it's about battling that in terms of a battle of education, and trying to appraise, especially young people, of the dangers of these things. Mm-hmm. The music scene, for instance, is a particular concern in Europe and in the United States. Neo-Nazi music scene. Some excellent music, I have to say, by the way, that I very much enjoy. But if you can start listening to the lyrics, some very dangerous messages are being purveyed there.
Okay.
And it's about, again, educating young people about the impacts of those messages.
Do you get a lot of outcry when you actually go after people online when it comes to racist music? I mean, there's always a fine line between freedom of expression and the work that you do. So how do you manage that then? I mean, the regulation of stuff online here is supposedly free. I mean, there's very little regulation. Should we move towards that?
Freedom of expression is always claimed. Again, it's a case of understanding the impacts and the consequences. It's one thing, incitement to violence has always been against the law in many, many nations around the world, in most nations around the world. And incitement to racist violence, where there's been a very close relationship between things that are said, things that are expressed, and violence against other people. The trouble is that with the media, with music and the internet and racist websites, that relationship between expression and violence is now very far removed. Mm-hmm. But these sorts of materials have a drip, drip, drip effect and contribute to a climate, to a culture in which this type of violence occurs.
Right, okay. So should, you know, and I'm thinking now it's no longer a countrywide surveillance system. It's a global issue. Is it easy to work with other countries to curb, offenders like these, online offenders?
I think the problem is different countries have different understandings of it. So, for example, when we talk about freedom of expression, the United States most famously has the First Amendment, freedom of speech.
Yes.
It covers a lot. Other countries, particularly Europe, don't have that. So they have freedom of expression, but they say it can be interfered with for certain circumstances, harm, morals, and things like that. So one of the issues is the different understandings of what material is or isn't illegal can get in the way. Partly because, of course, the freedom to be not insulting is not worth the paper to write on.
Yeah.
You know, in order to be able to push boundaries, we have to be able to upset people, we have to be able to anger people. But the difficulty is it goes too far, it goes into the hurt. So that makes it difficult to do things on a global level. But there are minimum standards, and they're increasingly happening so that people will say, yes, there are things. So, for example, there are a number of global treaties in relation to child pornography and to child sexual offences. There's also, within Europe, for example, there's treaties on xenophobia and racism.
Mm-hmm.
So where you can start getting minimum agreements of what action should be, then global cooperation is possible. But the problem is each country has its own set of values,
yeah,
and therefore there's a danger that you could be in the rush to the bottom, mm-hmm, in order to find what the minimum accepted grounds are.
Where do you see this going forward in the future, Alasdair? The whole idea of countries working together, because as long as we work in silos, we're not going to be able to do very much.
It's definitely the way forward. You can see it, particularly on the internet, because which country, you know, no one country owns the internet. So you're starting to see countries are having to cooperate. It takes a long time. If you think how long it takes for one country to agree something, try and get 100 countries to agree the same thing. It takes time. And that's one of the challenging things about all of our areas, is in order to respond to it, it will take a long time to introduce laws, but the criminals can react a lot quicker, which is why, to some degree, all three of us have talked about education as being the way forward, because actually if we can stop the need for the laws in the first place, it becomes a little easier. But certainly cooperation is happening, and what's happening is regional bodies tend to be getting together, and then those regional bodies are then cooperating with each other, so gradually you get a global context.
Paul, how would you conclude your message on hate crime?
Well, I think it's a battle of ideas here, and a battle around civility and how people treat each other. And again, to pick up Alistair's point, we've all talked about education in some way. And it's about winning the hearts and minds of people, and especially young people, to respect each other. But this is a global battle. We have disrespect for difference, people's differences, in most nations around the world, and certainly in the UK, despite 3 decades of anti-racist and multicultural education, the problem seems to be no less than it was many years ago. But we have to keep on battling for the hearts and minds, especially of young people.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Stewart, I mean, how would you console me? I'm concerned about crime in this country. How would you console me?
What a question. I think what I would say is that policing especially and the understanding about crime is moving forward all the time. So I think if time is spent trying to understand what the problem is and then looking to see what works as what works in the past, that's when you can prioritise your resources and make most impact.
Thank you all very much for joining me today. Paul Iganski from the Law School, Lancaster University, Dr. Stuart Kirby, Criminology Lecturer at Lancaster University, and Professor Alistair from the Law School as well, on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.